This is Dr. Colin McKay talking to me.
Oh, do you? All right.
But I find that picks up the background.
I see.
What can you remember about your family history as to memories of certain people? And can you tell me from the very start that you know about and how it progressed?
You know, that's an awfully sweeping question. I don't know whether I can even answer. So I think we're going to have to zero in on it a bit. But I'll give you a bit of background on it. But you may have had all this as well, worrying me. But Mr. W. Malcolm McKay, who owned this house, and this was his summer house. And, of course, he was, as you may have known, he was a timber merchant, lumberman, and probably the most successful one that St. John has ever seen, i.e., by the end of the first decade of the 20th century, 1911, 1912, 1913, he was shipping 45% of all the timber shipped from eastern Canada, including Quebec, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and the works. So he's a very successful, very hardworking, very successful man. But I won't go into all of his background. He was born in Quebec because his father was shipping timber out of Quebec City. When his father died in 1864, and his father was Hugh McKay, his mother took him back to Liverpool, and he grew up there, and then he was sent to Bangor by the family. There were McKays in Liverpool and McKays in eastern Canada. Started shipping timber out of Bangor, to be involved in the shipping of timber to the United Kingdom of Bangor, Maine. And then he subsequently comes back to, as a relatively young man in his 20s, to St. John, New Brunswick, start shipping timber out of here to A.F. and D. McKay, Archibald Fraser and Dan, in Liverpool, one of the oldest of the limited companies in Liverpool, England, an old company now owned but now sold to Swedish interests. So he was living in St. John. He lived in Orange Street. He spent his summers in his house in Rossay. Towards the end of the last century, he sold the Orange Street house, and he moved to Rossay full-time. But by that time, my grandmother's health was such that she lived to be a good age. She found winters fairly tough going, so they would go to Florida each winter. I can never remember, and by the time I arrived, I was born in 1920, they were not spending the winters in Rossay. Early on in the 20s, they went in the autumn and didn't return to the spring. But this was his home. He had five sons. The youngest was Ray McKay. He was killed within about 4 days of the end of the First World War. By the time he received my grandfather received the information that his youngest son was dead, the war was already over. He never really worked again after that. Mrs. Hugh McKay, I think, has the newspaper. I have a copy of it with his name on it, W.M. McKay, which he must have picked up in the office. He's the one with the account of his son's death. And he never really worked after that. His sons then ran the W. Malcolm McKay Limited, which was his timber business. So there you are. That's the house. When he died, it was left to my father. I'm sorry, when he died, my grandmother lived here in this house until 19. She dies in 1946, so she lives here until 1946. It was left to my father, and so they move in here in 47 or 48. They lived here, now I'm living here. So three generations of the family have lived in this house. They didn't build it, but it is the oldest house, to the best of my knowledge, in the village, as I call it, in the town of Rossay now. It would have been built in the 1840s. We use the figure 1842, but that's more of a guesstimate. You have nothing to say that. You know why the origin of this house, do you? Well, there were two houses originally here. There was this and what was known as the Domble House, one on this side of the brook and one on the other side of the brook. And there was a furniture factory and another little factory, I forget what just they did, at the brook, and the brook was down. And these were the two, a mill. There was a mill and a furniture factory, and the two owners of the furniture factory and the mill lived in these two houses. The other one was acquired by Senator Domble, a great grit senator from New Brunswick, and that house was burned. I just remember the Domble house being burnt down, on fire and being burnt. I'm going to guess it was 1925 or 26, 27, that period, the Domble house was burnt. And then when the Tilley house was torn down, which where Jim Irving Jr. lives now, the new Irving house, that was where the Tilley house was. It was older than this house, but this would now, I think, be the oldest house in the village. There may be one or two cottage is older, but I doubt it. You know that there's nothing really in Rossay until the railroad went through. You've been told that. Yeah.
Tell me what you remember or heard about the railway and the fact that...
I never conscious that the railway was here when I was here, and I don't know any stories about the railway. Not that I can remember. I just know from folklore, from stories, that a lot of these houses, the house I grew up in across the road here, it's called the Sheeling. That was probably put up at the time the railroad went through by somebody working on the railroad, a lot of them. The Ballantyne Cottage, it was in a couple of ones up when I grew up. growing up was known as the Ballantyne Cottage. It was on, and that you've been told about Jeff Kearse's blacksmith shop.
I have that down.
Yeah, well.
Tell me what you can tell me.
Well,
about
I can just remember it very clearly because I grew up on the other side of the road, as I told you, within a couple hundred yards of Kirsten's blacksmith shop. So it was replaced with a very small boy. You would visit. I can remember having been being forced or being, you know, I had to rest, as most children do. They're bedded down after lunch or in the midday. And I can remember very clearly, as a very small boy, hearing the pounding by Mr. Kirsten making the horseshoes in his blacksmith shop. And then, of course, we would all go up as children and watch him with the forge and the bellows, you know, making the horseshoes and fitting the horseshoes.
Did he ever allow you to
help? Oh, no, he was a sensible man. You don't. Well, one of the interesting things about Mr. Kirsten was that we used to say that he was a, what do you call him, Seventh-day Adventist. He was, I suppose, the only Seventh-day Adventist in the village. Have you been told this? Mm-hmm. And this is the reason. I don't think he was, like most, I don't think he was interested in being a Seventh-day Adventist, except he gave him two holidays. You see, when everybody else was working, at that time in the 20s and the 30s, everybody worked on Saturday, my father. But Jeff didn't, because the Seventh-day Adventists, that was their holiday. And then since you couldn't shoe a horse on Sunday, that meant he had 2 days off in the 20s instead of the else. But he was the old guard here. I remember when the Olins moved out here. Mr. Philip Olin's father moved up here. And somebody asked Jeff Kirsten about the Olins. He said he wasn't interested. They were just spring-ups. As far as he was concerned, the Olins were an old family, not to even be considered, you see. Well, not one of the old families of Los Angeles. So he would just, with a visit aside, they're just spring-ups. I'm not interested in the Olins. He wasn't at all interested.
What type of man was he?
Great man, Jeff Kearse. Oh, small, short man, wiry man. You know, a character, a bit of a character, yes. Had a comment on everything. I suppose he'd be loyal to stuff. The Kearses were loyal to stuff. I don't know who he connected with, you know, just what his connection with. He's a good fellow. His wife is also a bird of a woman from memory, with a very shrill voice. A little house below the blacksmith shop. It's still there. It's been redone. All changed. But by the tennis court, that's where he lived. The blacksmith shop itself was right on the road.
Now, were you much of a sailor or not?
Not really particularly, but I did sail because my grandfather had a large yacht, which I never saw. My father bought, for not very much, Sir Thomas Tate's yacht. In 1936, a fellow named Evans bought it after Tate died. It was built in St. Andrews. Very fine yacht called the Packhorn. And then my father bought that in, I think, 36 to 37 in that period. And I did sail in that, but I just sailed in that just before the war. Then you have the war, and then I went to university. To be president of the UBNB in 53, so I was really only sailing a very short time. No, I never considered myself a great yachtsman.
No.
We used to go off for weekends, but I never did any racing.
Who would you sail with when you
did? Well, my friends. I mean, I had the boat. A lot of them didn't, so I would take Fairweather might be with me, or Gordon Fairweather, relations or friends, and we'd go off for the weekend.
What type of boat was it?
It was a yawl, a 45-foot yawl. It was one of the very fine boats, as a matter of fact, one of the larger ones in the river at that time. But again, you know, to get you in perspective, you see, people forget, or your generations forget, nothing happened. I've got a picture in my office. I've got two photographs in my office at the university. One is the celebration in 1904 of Champlain's. They had a 300th anniversary of the arrival of Champlain in St. John at Market Square, you know, the Market Square area. And it's alive with people. I have also another photograph, which Mr. Costello of the newspaper gave me. They had it in the paper a few years ago, of St. John. High noon, say the 1935 or 36. There's only about two cars in the street. There's nobody around. You know, St. John was a much livelier city at the turn of the century than it was in the 30s. Nothing was happening in the 30s. The place, you know, this depression was very, very severe. You know. Nothing was going on. So, you know, the Rossi Yacht Club, there were about four yachts there, five yachts. Nobody could afford a yacht. You know. Everybody went bust in 29-30. The business owner, the Mackay Lumber Company went bust. Or W. Malcolm Mackay. Went belly up, and then it was reformed by my father as Mackay Lumber Company. But Mr. Hugh Mackay, who had been with my father, you may have been told about this, but he goes off, he's put into the put in by the bank to reorganize Fraser Brothers, because it had gone bust. You know, my memories of going to Fredericton as a small boy was seeing the piles of lumber outside of Fredericton at Morris's Mills, which were boards which were sawn in 28, 29. They rotted there, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34. Nobody could afford to buy them. Nothing happened in 29. This will come again, of course. You live enough to see the next depression, which is going to be more severe than the one that we've had, that one. Nobody believes me, but it will be. And if you think much is going to happen in the last decade of this century, I have news for you. It isn't, because you're going to be right in the depths of another depression, a very severe one. The wheel goes, sure it will.
Well,
You read some Mr. Toynbee history in the cyclical view of history. This is what happened. The wheel goes round and things go up and they go down. Mankind, ever since we've had the Industrial Revolution, you've had depression. You're going to have another. Well, each one has been more severe than the last.
So, how has Russia survived the depression?
Well, you stagger through, you know, you stagger through. Not much is happening, as I say. I know it's a big, I think the tuition at RCS then was $100 a year for a day boy. But it was a big question as to whether you know, my family is going to be able to find the $100 to send me to RCS. Because the family business had gone belly up. Well, my grandfather had money, but the reason he had money, he didn't give it away. And he wasn't about his sons had to stand on their own feet, so he wasn't giving them money. So father had to reorganize the business, but there was no money for extras. Now, you know, the $100, admittedly $100 then, is a lot more than it is now, a bottle of it. It was very slim picking.
What other things that were noticeable in the way that it went down?
Well, at that age, you don't know it. You've never had, you don't know, but certainly.
I've heard of
it. Well, one thing I would think, you know, the way of travel. You know, people travel the whole time now, but you weren't traveling then. You couldn't afford it, and B, there wasn't as much travel. It seems to me there's a lot of people who are doing quite a bit of traveling. I remember my parents driving to Toronto to see friends in the late 20s. But at the beginning of the 30s, you weren't getting your car and driving to Toronto or Montreal. You know, there wasn't the cash around to shoot off one place or another. So you stayed at home.
What about harboring? A lot of people took in people from English. I guess there's a lot of English.
Oh, well, that's coming to the war. That's quite different. The war is what cranks everything up again. No, if you want to know what it was like in the 30s, the people who came were the people riding the rails. And I have vivid memories of that. And banging on your door and wanting something to eat. And my mother getting quite distressed about this. One person after another, and I remember saying, we can't feed everybody. But they were riding the rails. They were out of work. So it was quite, they would get off here, come up and knock on your door, ask for something to eat. I suppose that happened every day, sometimes two or three times a day. I can't tell you the exact year, but I have vivid memories of it. And they would just go along this road, banging on the doors. They had no cash, and they were hungry. And everybody was unemployed, and most people were. No, when you talk about the war people, then you see once the war breaks out, it's a whole new ballgame.
What happened?
Well, I mean, people are then rushed off. That helped, you know. Lots of people in St. John, people from this city, I think lots of people who were here, they were out of a job. What they did, they would sit in the theater all day when you'd have the continuous bill. You know, they'd sit there all day, see the movie three times. You only had to pay about 25 cents. You could keep warm. They'd lost their business. They'd lost their office. Then they didn't want to sit around home. So they went in the theater and sat there from 2 in the afternoon to 9 or 10 at night or whatever it might be, or to 6 at night. But as soon as the war broke out, they joined up. They joined the services. You know, a lot of people were quite happy to see the war come along. It gave them a job again. They got some cash again. But then you started, the English children came out after the Battle of Britain. And it was though Britain was going to fall, and they shipped all the English kids out here. And Mrs. Humakai organized that for New Brunswick.
Oh, yeah,
well, Mrs., not the current Mrs. Humakai, but my aunt, who would be Mrs. Hope Mackay's mother. Mrs. Hope Hunter's mother organized that.
That was a new piece of information.
Oh, she organized the whole thing. She was the daughter of Sir Douglas Hazen, and she was very, A, politically minded, but B, she was a great person. Before they ever heard that, she never heard the word social work, but she did more in probably a day than most social workers do in a month now, just helping people out. But to set the example, because she did it, they took three children in there from the Tathan family. But they're going to have, asking people to take people, take children from England. She wasn't going to have her house, not with some in it. So Mrs. Tathan, who happened to be the Honorable Letitia Tathan, who was Winston Churchill's, a connection of Winston Churchill, she's Digby, she and her three children went to the Humakai house over there. And of course, the young Simon Bowes Lyon was the living down here, I forget who. Well, that was what his aunt, about Vincent Astor's boy, and then Simon Bowes Lyon, who was the Queen Mother's nephew. He was here for a while. You probably heard that story. Well, that's just to get those kids out of England, because they thought the thing was going to fall.
This is kind of way off base, but tell me, it's like jumping, but tell me about the tragedies on the river, things that you knew about, things like death or large accidents.
No, I can't remember any tragedy in the river, but there is one newspaper story which is headlined a narrow escape from death, and that's myself and Jeff Sarah, but it wasn't a narrow escape at all. We just went off. We went in one day in a, we were sailing an ice boat and it went through the ice. It wasn't any narrow escape. We just pulled ourselves onto the ice again. pulled the ice boat out and sailed home. So,
the sensation was amazing?
Well, I think it was like the press then is no different than the press now. Nothing very dramatic about it. So I can't remember tragedies at all. There may have been, I suppose, but I can't remember. Not conscious of them.
I see. What about train travel and train wrecks? What do you remember about... You must have went on the trains.
No, I don't think. No, we didn't. Again, we're not moving very much. Let's go back to the trains. Well, you know, a small boy. I'm born in 1920. Now, the pattern of this family was, as I say, my grandfather lived here. This is a change in society. My grandfather lived here. There were two people inside looking after him and two people outside. When my parents lived here, they had one inside and one outside. Now they're just my wife and myself. You see, that's how things change. So he had Butler, who was the chauffeur, Raymond Butler, and he had A.P. Archie Morton, who looked after the horse and the cow and this sort of thing. And what Morton would do, and this is in my memory, he would harness up the horse to the carriage of the sleigh, and he picked up Mr. Hugh Mackay and Mr. Malcolm Mackay and my father and took them to the train. Because then they went to work via the train. This is the early 20s. As you know, the first piece of paved road in New Brunswick was this piece from here to St. John. And my father is one of the early people, one of the first people who started to drive in wintertime to St. John. But of course, it was never plowed, so you couldn't drive when it wasn't plowed, or you worked your way through it. But once it's still really got top, then of course that's the engine.
What kind of car would he drive in?
Well, just an ordinary car, I don't know, with chains on it. I don't know what our car was then. I forget the first car. I remember the first, well, again, our early cars were second-hand cars. That first one was a second, and then he had a Buick, a 26 Buick, and then I forget what the depression one was. But again, there wasn't a lot of cash about.
Okay.
So that you asked me about trains. Now, I first went in a train. I don't know whether we went in a train. I have no memories of taking the train to St. John. Maybe I did when I was 6 or 7. But by the time I would have, and I was between the ages of 1 and 10, you're not going to the city very much. If I went in to see my mother's parents who lived in St. John, you would drive here. Now, the Irving buses start, I forget when they came along, but before 1930, I think they start about 26 or 27.
And so when do they take those out?
The buses? Mm-hmm. Well, do they still go? I don't know. Well, they went up to Gondola Point, roughly, that road and back. That was the first run. I don't know when they stopped. No, they don't go anymore. But see, you must remember, I haven't really lived here. You know, I lived in Fredericton for 16 years and lived in Ottawa for 20 years, so I've only been living here full time the last 2.5 years, so I don't notice these things. But once your bus starts, this is the way people went to St. Louis City, the way my mother used to go to the city. She didn't drive the car. So by the time we were schoolboys and going in, when I went to RCS, knew Wednesday afternoon off, you would go by bus. But I have no memories of taking the train. I may have taken it. I can remember the first time I went any place, I was in 15 or 16, I went to Montreal. The first time I saw a large city, and I must have been 16, the end of school. I didn't see Toronto until the war. I went overseas before I started university, so I didn't see Europe at that time. I was the exception, not the rule. When I came back after having toured around Europe, I was the only one of my age group who had done that. So everybody was, as now so many people will be going to Europe, or going overseas, or going any place, going around the world. But you didn't do that in the 30s. There was no way you could fund it, no way you could finance, no way you could do it.
So you're
here. You know, as a small boy or a small girl, you're just in the village. And you're,
well, what did you do to entertain yourself?
Well, just the same what children do today, I suppose. I don't know. Played games, and you're here. Then you're going to the school, and then you're in your school game. But it's within this community. I don't know if they got played. Then I went off. By the time I was 16, I was being sent to a boys' camp in Nova Scotia, probably 1934 or 5. So I was spending summers there, and I worked as a counselor in the camp. Perhaps from 1936 on, I was spending at least a month in Nova Scotia.
Tell me, you mentioned RCS. Tell me about that. Now, when you say RCS, I guess it's...
Well, I mean RCS now, but it is now. Yes.
Tell me about that. What are your recollections of it?
Well, you know how the school was founded. You know all about that.
No, I don't have a good description. Tell
well, it was started. My grandmother went there. That's why she was always interested in it. It started because the St. John burnt down in 1877. You've heard about the fire of St. John.
Yes,
all right. All the people, my grandmother was Macmillan. J.D. Macmillan, the printers in St. John, 1822, that's my grandmother Mackay's family. They had ones for sale now, right up by the public, what I call the public school, on the common. And, of course, their house had burnt down, so they couldn't go back to the city. They had to stay here for the winter. And Len Pierce, he used to be the janitor at RCS, his father, one of the Pierces, ran a sort of school for the village. And from what I've always, as I understood it, in the building they used, there was an unoccupied upper floor. So this is how, so somebody... They engaged the parents as a schoolmaster, starts the school in 1877, which is really just a day school. And And there were boys and girls at that time. So, and then it becomes the boys' school, and then the Church of England comes in, and then it moves up there. But it starts in 1877 because of the St. John Fire. Now, I was there. My father went there, and all his brothers went there. And then I was there. I guess I started in 31, so I'm there from 31 to 39. But I was a day pupil. But I did board the last year after. Yes, I did board the last year. I went back to senior matric and boarded. Mm-hmm. 38, 39, I guess.
Okay. A lot of people who are day people spent their last couple of years boarding. Why was that?
Not too many. Some did. I guess some did. Well, it was just to get a, you know, good experience. But you can get away from your home and live someplace else.
Have an independent experience.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Because I am aware that the day people and the boarding people, more so in other words, would be treated slightly different. Is that correct?
Not in the RCS. No, and I don't think. I don't know how differently treated. Some of the people feel that Nellie, Miss Canong, who ran that school, she didn't more than run it. She founded the thing pretty much. I mean, so she obviously now, as you look back, was a quite extraordinary woman. But because she believed in very strong discipline, some people have. Strange memories of it, but folklore is folklore. After you told a story 10 times, you improve the story each time you tell it. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking to somebody who's 60 or 70 or 80, as I am now, the story they're telling today about Netherwood or RCS is a very much better story than they told in 30. And the more you tell a story, the less fact it is, and the more fiction it becomes. So that's the trouble talking to somebody my age. There's more fiction than fact in the story. I don't think that they probably do. But Miss Canong had that very, as I understand, very, my sister went there as well. And there were quite severe rules. I think it's fair to say that Miss Canong probably was more interested in having the boarders than the day pupils. She had both, but I mean, she was, her concept of the school would be, you know, you can give a complete education if you have them under your care and control the whole time. But your ideas, and she obviously had definite ideas. Her brother, W.F. Canong, was one of them. The Canong Hall at UNB St. John is named after them. They were great. He was one of our leading educators and scholars and historians. And so from him, she got a lot of ideas about education. She has very firm ideas. I'm not saying whether right or wrong, but you've got ideas and you want to put them into operation. And you want the kids, I assume, with you as much as possible. So you can see whether your ideas are right or not. And then I think that's from this you get people feeling that she treated one group differently than another. I'm guessing, but I think she probably is more interested in the board.
Don't get me wrong. It wasn't put in a nasty.
No, I know what you mean, but I'm just saying I think it's... It was really the
yes.
Her program was for a boarding school, and that's what she was most interested in.
Now RCS, tell me, what were you involved with the hockey team?
No, I wasn't an athlete. I played games, but I'm not an athlete. I wasn't even on the hockey team.
Okay,
yeah.
So what did you do, or as a day person? Okay, when would you go to school? When would you come home? You had to probably obviously help at home quite a bit, as most people seem to.
Well, no, I don't. I didn't actually. Again, we didn't. You know, we always had somebody. I said there was no cash. There wasn't. But there were always people around poor. Now, this would be the pattern. This is a pattern in Brunswick. When I was a very small boy, in the 20s, before the Depression, we always had a maid, which never lasted very long. Because as soon as they learned how to wait on a table, and how you set a table, and so on, and got some training, they hived off to Boston or someplace where they could make a lot more money working in a home there. And that's why you have somebody like President Kennedy when we had him at UNB. I remember a lady meeting him, said, oh, yes, my aunt or my mother, you know, was one of your nursemaids in Boston. You never had a maid more than a few months, a year and a half. Once she learned from my mother how you did things, she hightailed it for Boston.
They must have been awfully young.
They were young, sure. You know. But they were a nursemaid. They looked after myself and my sister, too. You know, they were general factotums, did all the things. So I never had to really work in the kitchen. Or my sister never had to work in the kitchen. We always had somebody in the kitchen.
Oh, no. Or anything.
No. We, in that sense, you know, we were much better off than an awful lot of people. But as I said, there wasn't much cash around, but there was obviously enough to pay somebody in the kitchen. And most of the people in Rossay did have help at that time. It's all gone now, but very few homes here that didn't along this strip.
Okay. Well, then you spent basically the bulk of your day there.
At the school. Yeah, really, you would, because you'd go up early. I don't know what time classes start at 9, chapel was either 8:45 or 8:40 or something like that, so you go to chapel first. So I suppose you're there around 8:30, 8:29. You have chapel, and then you start your classes. And then there's football in the afternoon, or there's hockey, or there's these different things, or sports you're staying for. And there wasn't much of a library then. No schools had any libraries to speak of. You might come home, if there wasn't something going on in the school, suppose you came home and and did lessons and whatnot. We did a lot of homework. I did a lot of homework.
How many hours did you put in
the homework? I couldn't tell you, except that, you know, my mother came from educational background. Not that she was a university graduate, but her parents were. And so she believed in people doing a lot of work. She made sure I did a lot of work.
Which is much to your
benefit, actually. Well, I would work at home. Okay. But I did my first 6 years at the public school up here.
Okay, tell me what... Okay.
No, because there were good teachers there.
Who were some of your teachers?
Well, Miss McMurray taught all of us. I mean, you've heard her name time without number. So she was a very extraordinary person.
Okay.
I remember her, and there was another one. Smith was a very good one. I must have had her in grade 3 or 4. Grade 4 or 5, perhaps. Smith was a good teacher, and Miss McMurray was quite an extraordinary teacher. Was listed at the front end of her grade. She was
so they would teach all subjects?
Well, yes. It works, yeah. Yeah, I don't think even in grade 5. Well, I've got to be careful. Whether it be other people, certainly grade 1, 2, and 3, you just have one teacher from memory. Now, whether by 5 you have somebody else, I don't know. I can't remember. But I'm not conscious of having a lot of people. I'm conscious of having a Miss McMurray in grade 1, a Miss Howard, I don't think I'd part of grade 2. And then I think Smith was, I forget.
They combined classes, correct?
Well, yes. We were combined 2 and 3, I think. Yes. Not in the grade 1, but we had to combine 2 and 3. I don't know why, whether it was short or whether it was small numbers of us. I don't know the reason. But I know, I have a feeling that I wasn't combined. In other words, I was grade 1, 2, and 3, but when I was in 3, there was a 2 combined with us. But my memory's a bit fuzzy on that. But I know in that 2-3 period, grade 2 and grade 3, I wasn't a combined. Now, whether I was in 2 with a 3, or whether I was in a 3 and the 2 was with us, I can't really remember. And I can't give the reason why that was done, whether it was shortage of teachers or what.
Okay, then you moved on to the RCS.
Yeah, for grade 6, yeah.
Okay. What was that because you could not continue in the public
school? Oh, no, we could have. No. But our family had a close connection with the Rossa schools, I tried to explain. You know, my grandmother was involved in it. All my brothers went there. All my father and all his brothers went there. My cousins were going there, so just assumed I would go there.
I see. So the public school would take you pretty much right
after graduation? Well, right to graduation, yeah.
I see. So you did graduate from RCS.
That's correct, yeah.
What was a graduation at RCS like? What would you wear? What would you do?
No, there really wasn't much of a graduation. Well, I forget how many graduated when we graduated. It was about 7 or 8, I think, was all in my class. Again, it's a depression class. Yeah, very small. But you just wore flannels and a blazer, I guess. And the school was smaller than it is now. I mean, it's not very big now, but, you know, again, it was as it is now, I guess, again, fighting for its life. You know, nobody could afford to send people. So there were very few. From memory, I think there was 8 in my class that finished. It was 8 or 9. Several were killed in the war, so there was very few of us left now, because only 3 of us left.
Was there a dinner?
No, not from memory, no. It's just graduation. Yeah. I don't know whether the public schools made the fuss over it then that they do now. I don't think they probably did.
I don't think they did half of it.
Certainly there was no fuss at RCS. You reviewed a school closing exercise. So we spoke, that's all.
What were some of the events?
And there was a school dance, either before or afterwards. I think it was the night of the closing. I can't remember which one. I think it was the same night of the closing. It was the night before. What they called the June dance.
And would you wear the same thing to dance that you did?
I would expect so, but I don't hold them to do that. I would assume you wore blazers and gray flannels. Okay. I'm guessing.
All right.
And we wore the school uniform, of course, which I don't
Why
think they do anymore.
Why did you give me a description of that?
Well, it was one that was designed that they wore that for years at ours. I can't remember. It was an Oxford gray. Which verging on black uniform, which we all wore. And that was designed when my father was there. They wore it, I think. And it was, well, I don't know when they stopped wearing it. But it was a very good idea because everybody was dressed the same.
Made everybody to an equal.
That's exactly it.
Tell me about what type of annual events might have went on at RCS. Were there any things like people coming?
I think there was a bit. They had school plays and you had people to speak to you and so on. But... Not as much as it does now. Yeah, I suppose, again, they couldn't afford to bring anybody there, but I can remember, for example, one on Miss Smith, who was connected with Mount Allison, and I remember she speaking to us in the dining halls where people would speak to her, but she'd been in Russia. Mm-hmm. Nobody talked to her, told us much about Russia, but she'd been there just, well, of course, the revolution hadn't taken place in 1920, 1921, so on. So, and I'm trying to think when that would be. I suppose she must have talked to us in the school, let's say, 33 or 34, 10 years after the revolution. She had a lot of photographs. But that's for my first memory of hearing about such a thing as a revolution, or the Russian Revolution. And she talked it. And there must have been others, but I can remember that one. You would have that there was no assembly hall, so really, I guess we had that in the dining hall. But there again, you see, that schoolhouse that they have now, Mr. Ward Pitfield and others, who had gone to the school in 1928 or 27, 28, they said they needed a new schoolhouse, so they would raise the money for it. But then the crash came. They were in difficulties. A lot of the money was promised, never came forward to pay for the schoolhouse. So suddenly people had no money. So there was a great difficulty in paying for that after it was finished, because the pledges couldn't be honored because people were bust.
There must be things I'm missing in about RCS, the memories that I'm not being able to find.
Well, no, I'm a bit leery. Maybe my memory is fading, but I've been around schools and universities to know most of the people, alumni and whatnot, the things that they say are their memories are myths. You know, these are things that the great event, which really wasn't a great event, blown up all proportion as the years go by. So until the end, it bears no resemblance to fact. Some people tell you about, you know, the knights, they did thus and so. Well, it really wasn't a big event. Then in their old age, they see it as being a big event. And I think most of things are pretty, you go on day after day the way you do anything else. In a small school, a little village, you're not going to have any great events. And they appear as a great event in memory as you look back on it.
Has it meant more to you?
It may, yeah, but I can't think of anything.
I have an interesting question.
And again, did we have, I suppose you can think of great events of, if you had so-called important people visiting. I'm not conscious of any, say, leading politician or visitors, but probably partly because of the Depression. You didn't have a lot of people. The school couldn't pay people to come and speak, and so you didn't have people on the lecture circuit. And I think I'm correct in saying, I haven't never really thought too much about this, but you just didn't have people, moving around. Say, starting a lecture, there's just schools in Vancouver and ending up here. A, the school couldn't afford to pay them, and if they were a distinguished person from Britain, they couldn't afford to come out here anyway. There wasn't a lot of travel in the Depression in those 10 years.
This is something.
So that, they weren't around.
Okay, what about the
effects? On that, I think, just one other side, I think my guess is, and this is just a guess, but I have a feeling that perhaps Netherwood had more of this than RCS. Again, Miss Ganong was interested. And she would have musicians here, like a string quartet or something like that. Perhaps Toronto was here. Or if they were playing the community concert here, she might also get them to come to the school. Someplace in this house, there's a little charcoal drawing by Arthur Lismer of my sister, who was head girl of the school. And so obviously he visited the school, must have talked about art or painting. And I think probably she did more of that than was done at RCS. Because Dr. Hibbert was not a young man when I was at the school. He was trying to hold the school during the Depression. But he was an old, tired old man by the 30s. And so and getting very rigid in many things. Not very forward-looking at that point, just trying to keep the thing together.
He
went there, I don't know how long he was there, but he began before 1910 as headmaster. He's still there in 1930. If you'd ask me, if I had any inspiration when I began, if I was still president of UNB 30 years after I went, I wouldn't have many ideas left, and I'd be too tired to implement them anyway. So, if we're unkind, even if we're kind about it, probably Dr. Hibbert overstayed his time in RCS to keep a vibrant, flourishing school. He'd run it up by ideas. So the place was really coasting in the Depression, hoping, to get enough people there to keep closing the doors.
Yes, you've got to be pretty strong just to keep it together.
That's right. So there wasn't nothing of an inventive, nothing very exciting.
What about teachers you remember, favorite subjects, or subjects that they don't take now, like Latin?
I think there are some teachers I can remember. Cox taught me in English. He was there for a number of years. He was quite good in English. Jackson was a good science teacher. I didn't particularly like science. I wasn't much good in it. But Jackson was a good teacher. The teacher for about Legasic was an Englishman, and Tommy Legasic was a good teacher, too. Cooper taught classics. I don't know if he left while I was there or not, but I think he probably did. I'm not conscious of Cooper being there when I left. He was there for a number of years. He was English. Again, you had poor Englishmen who couldn't get jobs in England come here. Kibo was an Englishman, known as Fanny Kibo, but he was there a long time. It was there after I was there. And he was a reasonable teacher. But you didn't have any great scholars as teachers. A school like this isn't going to attract them. But they're there, I would say Cox, and certainly Cox, and Jackson, as I mentioned, were competent teachers. And who else did I mention? Then, of course, we had the manual training, which was usually the cadet corps. Captain Dew ran both of those. Known as Dickie Dew, but Richard Dew. So you had that, and that was people seem to be astounded today that my generation went to RCS and hammer and nail. Well, that's we did. We did a lot of manual. It was once or twice a week. You took manual training certain once a week.
Oh really?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So you did learn to.
What else was included besides hammering?
Well, I mean, you learned it. You built things. You built. I don't know if there's any of the stuff left in this house, but you built tables and you built little things like that. And you built book racks and this sort of thing.
So shop was a mandatory thing.
Oh yes. Yeah. Everybody took it in school. Yes, you would call it shop. Now we call it manual training. Yes, everybody took it. And that's, and like most of those schools, like all of them, it's not whether you want to take things or whether you don't want to take them, you took them. There wasn't a lot of, there were no options. There was no option in the academic program. There was no option in the, you weren't good enough to make the intercollegiate team, you still played games. I mean, in other words, just because you didn't make a football team that was playing St. John High School, that means you didn't play any games, I mean, unless you were physically, had a medical certificate.
Did you have like a gym class then?
Yes, yes. Yeah, we did have gym class, sure we did. Yeah. And then there was basketball. Yes, your gym classes. Yeah.
Because you didn't at the public school, from what I have gathered.
Well, you did, but it was not gym, because there were no gyms.
It was stretching.
But you did it just by standing up I can remember in the public school, you stood up between the, you know, just by your desk and stretched. Yeah, you're right. But there were no gym. There was no gym at this public school, and that was the only school in the area. And I don't know, I suppose whether there were gyms in the high schools in St. John or the schools, I can't tell you. Yes, there would be. Not in the province. I think in the junior schools around the province.
What about musicals?
There was no really music. I grew up here without knowing anything about music, art. These were unknown things to people.
They weren't practical, so they weren't.
Well, no, it wasn't that so much. Perhaps again because of the lack of funds, but there was just nobody. Very few people had any paintings in their home. You couldn't afford them. The Depression, I suppose that was it. But. Neither my mother or father went to university. They had no education, if you want to call it art appreciation. There were lots of books. We always had lots of books around.
Books were big for entertainment, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, as they've always been. But, I mean, I've got books in this house, which were the 1830s and 40s, been owned by the family, because we settled in Kent County after Nova Scotia. We moved from Pictou to Kent County and then down here. Mm-hmm. But I can show you books there in the 1830s and 40s, when I'm owned by the family. So, actually, you must remember, of course, the flowering in New Brunswick. You know, in 1867, when Confederation starts, you probably know this, but St. John had the highest per capita income in Canada. It was the wealthiest city in Canada. Now it's one of the poorest. You know, it's been downhill now for over 100 years in St. John. But this was a thriving, prosperous city with a lot of intellectual activity. And it's been getting worse and worse every year that passes. Now, at the university here, there's a bit of... it's been reversing. I mean, the fact that people want to start to buy capital shows it. But the fact that the city council is not at the premier's door wanting to get the bicapital finished shows you something about St. John. Like it tells you a lot. Yes. There's resistance to finish the bicapital. When the federal and the provincial governments want to get on with it, it shows St. John area, and this is really part of St. John. It doesn't happen. But again, I don't want to downplay it. But there's still lots of culture. There is cultural activity. But there was a turn of the century with Mechanics Institute and all of these sort of things. A lot livelier intellectual activity, or a livelier place intellectual. I mean, St. John's one of the few cities I visit now where there isn't a decent bookstore. Now, at the turn of the century, I'm sure the bookstores here were as good as they were in Montreal in the 1890s. And all that died with a few depressions, and economic really downturn, and virtual economic collapse once the days of the chips were.
One more thing about ourselves. Do you remember any chance at school type of unity, feeling along that way? Okay, you said there weren't very many people, so...
Well, yeah, that's again, I don't think there is. There was, you had school yells and whatnot, and there was, but it's, I'm a small boy, but there's not many of us. We're like an overgrown family, so it's really a very small school when you think of it.
What about pranks that were played? Anything
you
can recall?
I can't remember them being, not particularly, no, I'm sure there were some.
Halloween pranks? Anything that
nothing extraordinary. We used to go out Halloween, then there was a period, as you brought, one by, there used to be a lot of destruction on Halloween. Nothing out of the ordinary that I can remember. And I can't remember any particular pranks at the school. But again, of course, I was only a boarder that one year. And I think really that sort of thing takes place more on the people who are there, though.
Yes.
As boarders. Yeah.
Okay. Ben Parks and Archie Morton, did you say?
Not Ben Parks. No, Ben Parks worked Ben Parks worked for the Bells.
That's
at one
right.
Time. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was confused.
No, Raymond Butler.
Ray Butler. J.P. Morton.
No, Raymond Butler was my grandfather's chauffeur. A very, very fine man. He came over. I forget when Butler joined the family. I couldn't tell you. It's 1910 or 11 or thereabouts. And then he went off and was in the army doing the first war, and then he came back. But I remember he lived in a little house down by the butler lived in the cottage, which I own just by the brook here, where Mrs. Smith lives now. And he was, as I say, he was my grandfather's chauffeur. I remember my grandfather would take us fishing in Prince Edward Island. I remember going once with my cousin Bill Mackay and his father and my grandfather, and then of course Butler drove us. But then after my grandparents died, he was with my grandmother. And then when they went to Florida in the winter, Butler went with them, because they had a car, their car was left there. So he spent the winter with them in Florida. And they drove there, and then they came back here. They left the cars that were here, they had two here, those were just left here, and then they had a car in Florida. So Butler drove them there. And then he was with the Humakais after my grandmother died in the little cottage there. He lived in. And then Morton was the... Well, I'll just tell you about Morton. Now, I don't know when Morton was. In my memory, he was always part of the family. But the way grandfather operated, when they lived in St. John, and Morton was with them in the city. Now, I suppose they had a chauffeur then, too. Whether Butler was with them, then I can't remember. But when they were living there in the winter, then when they'd come out here in the spring, Morton would lead the horse out and the cow out. Because then in Orange Street, you know, they kept the cow behind the house in Orange Street. And so he brought them out here. And the barn was just where the garage, no, the garage, but the left of the weather vane on the garage was on the barn. I can remember the barn. And so then he worked. He planted the garden. He looked after the hens because it was all, they kept hens here. So he did all that sort of thing. And he was the one that drove the horse. And when I talked about them taking the train to go to work in the 20s, Morton drove them. He picked the three sons up. My grandfather, as I explained to you, is no longer working. Three, Malcolm and Hugh and my father Colin, who were living here, were picked up by Morton and driven to the village. And so he did all those sort of things. And when he was with my grandmother after grandfather left, you know, she was sitting with a fire in the fireplace. And Morton had to bring up the wood. You know, he did all. He was in the house.
So he was a handyman as well.
Oh, he did everything. He did everything. And then they had two maids as well, of course, to look after the kitchen and everything.
Who would look after the maids more so than
me? Oh no, I'm talking this house with my grandparents. No. Morton wasn't with, no. Morton was with my grandfather and my grandmother. Yeah. And Butler, yeah. We never had a chauffeur. But then Morton, by the time my grandmother dies in 1936, Morton then really retires. He doesn't carry on. My parents, I'm sorry, by the time my grandmother dies after the war in 45, Morton may have, well, I suppose Morton is still with her. But I forget when Morton retired. But certainly Morton didn't carry, Butler carried on with the Humakais. Morton, he may have been with my grandmother, and she died in 1946. Was it 46? 46. She died in May 46. Then I guess Morton must have retired about that at that time, because he certainly didn't continue working with any other members. But he probably was with her, right? But I know that latterly, at that time, she had other people working, somebody cutting the lawn and whatnot. It was too much for Morton to go on. But he was he was a handyman, but with a capital H. Very fine person. He was just a joker. And as I say, he looked after the animals. He could do all sorts of things. Some of the old wiring in this house was done by him. Mrs. Hunter said something about it's a piece of furniture. Oh, that was repaired by Butler. So they were very much, they weren't servants in that master-servant relationship at all. That was the pattern of that time. We referred to them as Morton, their last name. We called them Morton, and we called them Butty as children. That's what we called them. We never thought of them in terms of a master servant. They were very much part of the family, and I think they saw it. And the tremendous loyalty from them. They didn't just work an 8-hour day. They worked when they were needed. Of course they did. Great people, just great people.
Yes, I believe that all chauffeurs had to go an extra mile. As sure. Well, they were treated well, too, though.
I think they were treated
well. Worked both ways.
Yeah, sure.
Tell me if you remember the Kennedy Hotel.
Oh yeah, well yes I do. Of course I remember Arthur Kennedy was one of the greats in this town. I've been trying to get this piece of strip highway named after him for years.
But, oh, you have.
Well, I got the village council wouldn't pass it at one time. But Arthur Kennedy was a very, very fine person.
Now, what was he like? What did he look like? What did he act? What did he do?
Well, he looked like what we all look like. people, but he had to bring up the Steele family, because when their father died, there was no money. Arthur was running the garage there. I just remember his father. They came to St. Martin's. His father ran the Kennedy House. Well, actually, Mrs. Kennedy, I mean, old Mrs. Kennedy, who I just vaguely remember, she really ran it. And Joe Kennedy, Slambo, was just sitting on the veranda. He didn't do much work. And then Arthur lived there and wasn't married. And then Arthur did marry, and his wife, I think before they were married, was running the switchboard. Because the switchboard, you probably know all this, was in the Kennedy, was in the Kennedy House. But Arthur ran the garage behind. That's really what he did. It had been livery stable and horses. But Arthur was very good to all of us growing up. We got in trouble, the cars broke down. Arthur would go and collect you. And then Arthur also did sell cars a bit for Mr. Miller. They were all from St. Martin's. And Miller sold the Dodge Plymouth agency in St. John. My mother had a small Dodge, which Arthur Kennedy sold to us. So he also did some selling of cars. But Arthur was just a very, very fine gentleman, as I said. And again, I remember Arthur saying to my father, asking to see my father in the 30s, and saying to him that he had a problem. And the problem was, a lot of the people who should have known better weren't paying their bills. Now, they couldn't afford to, but they were still getting Arthur to fill up their tank. And he would let them charge it at that time. And some of the people who should be nameless were living on Arthur, if you see what I mean. You know. They were still driving their car, but they hadn't paid for the gas in it.
Abusive.
Sure they were, but Arthur was too much, as my father said to Arthur, you know, he said, you've got to stop giving them gas. Oh, I couldn't do that. He said, you simply must. But you can't let people take advantage of him. But Arthur was the kind of person which is a decent person, an honorable person. No, we are very fond. I think all of us growing up at that time, any of us at my age or older, have nothing but the best of memories of Arthur. It's been very good to me.
It's funny. I haven't received a description. Okay, I've had kind-hearted. Was he quiet? Was he loud? Was he talkative? Was he liberal or conservative?
Well, he was conservative, of course. The Kennedys were very strong conservatives. No, he wasn't. He's an amusing fellow. Some of you know any of the Steeles. They, you can see that. His mother, I mean, their mother was a, I've got to get it straight now. Arthur's their uncle of Joe and John and all of them. And I can see Arthur and some of them. Mr. John Steele, I can see Arthur and him. He had a good, very pleasant laugh. I think he had a considerable wit. He could be amusing. He could be cutting if he wanted to be. Not in a nasty way. But he was one of these very reliable. He was a medium height. Good features, you know, gray eyes, dark hair, and then gray hair. And I remember talking to him. You know, he died at 85 or 86. And I remember walking up and down the street here. But he was, gradually, he was the only one of that generation left.
Did he do repairs on the house, or who did
that? No. No, he was just running the garage.
That's all he did.
Oh, yeah, well, that was for, you know, I
don't mean to belittle it.
No, but I mean, for example, we left our car there in wintertime. It was a heated garage. I'm trying to remember what sort
it
of...
It wasn't heated, I didn't...
It was a big garage. It was at the back, not where the Irving Station is. That's where the Kennedy House is. Mm-hmm. But then it's down behind the garage. It was a big, long garage. You can put 15 or 20 cars in it. He housed a lot of cars there in wintertime. People left their cars, like my father. And I think either Arthur would even bring them down in the morning, I forget, whether we'd go up together. But even the 1940s, that's where he kept the car in wintertime.
Because this big heated
garage. Oh, yeah. And they did repairs there, too. I mean, they did maintenance, and Arthur did that sort of work. And he had other people with him working. They maintained the garage. You filled up there. So it was quite an operation of Kennedy's garage.
So Mrs. Kennedy must have been the one who really ran the hotel.
But Mrs. Kennedy, yeah. But see, Arthur was her son, and then he lived in the Kennedy House.
Mm-hmm.
And then his wife helped Mrs. Kennedy. She got older, and then she ran the Kennedy House, Arthur's wife, after his mother died. She was a hairdresser. She ran the hairdressing parlor, surely. Forgot, just remembering that. She was a hairdresser. She had a hairdressing parlor in the Kennedy House.
Oh, I never.
I think her name was Tid, but I could be wrong. Miss Tid was a name like that. But she was a miss when she comes there. And Arthur's living there, and he's single, and they're married.
So was it still a boarding house when Arthur was there?
Oh, yes.
So it did carry on that long.
Oh, yes, because he's running the garage, and then his mother dies, his wife is running it.
I see.
In the mid-30s. People used to spend the summer there.
Yes.
A lot of people come on and spend the summer. But his wife was running it then. Mrs. Arthur Kennedy was running it. As I say, I don't know when Mrs. Kennedy died. You could easily find out, but I'm sure she's dead by 1930. Mm-hmm. Or she's certainly not active in the house. And I'm going to say she died before Joe Kennedy died. And Joe was living there, really, and I suppose Arthur's wife looking after him.
I see. Oh.
And they lived out in the L. I mean, the front rooms. It was a T-shaped building, and they lived out in the L. The kitchens were underneath. Yes, with his front part, mm-hmm. facing up this way. It was a three-story building. It was a big entrance, you know, I mean, it was a big dorm. Again, there was just one dorm, or whether it was three out of three, it was one of the big dormers jutting out.
Okay, just to change the subject, do you remember Mr. Diggle?
Very well, yeah.
He was a very patriotic person.
Well, he was English, of course, yeah.
What was the store like in the way that, what type of things could you purchase there?
Well, it was like any country store, but Mr. Diggle, you know how he, what his background is. Well, he was, he worked on Robert Thompson's yacht, and then he worked in the Union Club, and whether he worked as a steward on a ship, I don't know. He probably did, I forget, way back, but then that's his background, and by 1920, he certainly had the shop there, but he sold everything. It was a country store. But of course, both the shop, both his and the other one, that you ran the thing on credit. I mean, you could charge them. So.
That would be abused too, I think.
I probably was in the 30s, yes, yeah. But no, Mr. Diggle was a very fine man. It was all the RCS, we used to go there and buy stuff from them, what they call the fly pad, you know, the raisin squares and whatnot.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. I don't know who made those. They were, you know, sort of tray things. It's obviously the bakery. It must have been some St. John bakery who brought them out. Slow thing. But he did everything. He was behind the counter with his pencil behind his ear, and you went in order, and he wrote it down. And, of course, they had delivery, too. He always had a delivery boy with a bicycle. So everybody phoned their orders. I mean, my mother and the different wives would phone their orders. And he took it down, and then it was delivered. So you didn't have to go up and do your order. You did it all by phone. Or you could do it by phone. And Georgie was one of his delivery boys. They weren't paid very much. Mr. Diggle wouldn't pay them very much, and they were very bright. And then his daughter, Nessie, worked with him, too, latterly. Whether she worked when I was very small, or I don't know whether she did work there. But certainly latterly, she was with him the whole time. It's a typical little square country store with a pot-belly store stove in the center to keep it warm with a pail of water on.
Spittoon?
No, I can't remember the spittoon, no. But that was just a heater. You were heated with a pot-belly stove in the center. As you went in, you know, as you went in the door here, the stove would be there. There was a counter there and a counter here. But he operated from the counter on the right. He was behind that counter on the right with all the goods. Tin goods behind them. And then he kept other stuff. I know, but obviously there was stuff out behind flour and whatnot at the back of the shop. He didn't go out there.
Did he have a cash register?
Oh, yeah, there was a cash register there. Yeah.
But he did a lot of that into his head, much more so than today. On brown paper? Is that
he always kept in a piece of brown paper. He told me that, yeah.
That was for like your receipt more so than his, is that correct?
I suppose so, yes. He just put the things down and put the price beside them and he told you what it cost. I can't remember how he billed, whether he billed the people at the end of the month, I suppose he used to. I mean, there was a period, you know, people were only billed every 3 months at one time.
Oh,
yes, because one of the first things my father did, he went to work for his father at the age of 16, was, you know, he would pay all the bills every quarter. He went around St. John instead of wasting the money on a penny stamp. My father was dispatched to pay all the bills that you'd accumulated in the previous 3 months.
Oh.
And if people weren't going to give you 3 months credit, you didn't deal with it.
What about the other store? I haven't had a lot of information.
Well, it was Robertson's and I was there, a variety, and then it was Merritt's, Lou Merritt ran it, and that's where the post office was. It was in here, in a wicket at the back. But it didn't have the continuity of ownership, which when I was a very small boy, I'm sure it was Robertson's, and by the time I was 9 or 10, it was Merritt ran it. I don't know whether Lou Merritt had run it, whether he worked there before he ran it, but he wasn't the... If I can use the word character or individual, the Mr. Diggle was, you wouldn't remember him either fondly or otherwise.
Did the store change very much as it passed hands, the Robertson?
Not too much, no. A bit. Yes, it did, because then whoever gets it, then they had, well, it really expanded there, because they had a meat counter and so on, because some of them, the Sobeys, I mean, some of those people went up. I don't know who owned it after the war, because I wasn't here very much. But it did grow, it expanded more than Mr. Diggle. Mr. Diggle's changed very little. And he took the attitude that no matter what they did over there, he would keep his customers, and he probably did. And he wasn't going to make any post-war changes. So he carried on, to the best of my memory, after 1945, just the way he had before 1945.
He had the character, too.
And then, how much longer Nessie Kate kept the store going after he died, I forget. Not very much longer. But again, I wasn't.
This may be a dumb question. The Robertsons who owned the store would not be the same or related to the D.D. Robertsons.
No, not from the best of my memory, they weren't, but I don't hold me to that.
The golf, you were a tennis player, were you?
Oh, I played tennis, I played at it, you know. My tennis, I organized the junior development after the war. It was junior development of the Canadian Lawn Tennis Association. I took that on and organized that right after the war. But then I played a bit. But again, as I say, by the time I was, we didn't have any coaching when I was growing up on these things, so I never learned to play tennis well, except I went to these boys' camps in Nova Scotia, probably from the age, you see, of 14 on. So I was here for, I was over there for a month. And but I never learned to play tennis well. And I played a bit of, I never really learned to play golf well either. I was a member of junior member of the golf club, but I never played most, and I really didn't play much well.
I see. Okay.
I think we started when he was a small, when he was growing up, the turn of the century, he was active in the, I know Mr. Campbell Mackay said the first, he hired Bruce Holder, to, gave him his first job, and he played at the, that's not the current Bruce Holder who's still alive, but his father, who was the first orchestra here and played for all the dances when I was young, St. John, was Bruce Holder. But Campbell Mackay always said he gave him his first job and he hired him to play at the Rossay Yacht Boat Club, or whatever we called it then, Rossay Yacht Club. But that building was put up, I think it says, what, it's 60 years old, isn't it? I don't know when that building, but those things were formed, you know, as Rossay, I suppose, began to grow. And about the same time, my grandfather was, you know, living here full time, and so then you have the tennis club. I think it started at the turn of the century, and then the yacht club and so on. In other words, those things didn't exist in the 1770s and 80s. They come around at the end of, you know, the beginning of the 1900s. I'm guessing, but I don't know.
Were you ever involved in Mark Jackson's dancing club?
Yes, I was.
Can you give me a good idea of what that was about or where it took place?
Well, in her home. Mark Jackson and the Blanchette. I remember going to the, she was Margaret Peters, mm-hmm. and you went to the Peters house one night a week, and then you went to the Blanchette, Helen Blanchette, I think it is. Don't hold me to her first name. And then the next week, I don't know how many years before that. That was just to teach you how to dance.
Was it?
Yeah.
And
I don't know what age. I can't even guess the age. 10 years, 12 years of age, I don't know.
And where would they get the music from? Was it played? Or would
it be just, I suppose, grandma.
I see. What do you remember of Dr. Peters?
Oh, I remember very well, because he was your friend, the doctor. He had all the aches and pains, yeah.
And
what? He was the doctor for the school, too.
Yes, I had heard that. What type of person was he in the way of, did he take, I know he was a family farm doctor, which means very down-to-earth type of person, I suppose. And from what I know of him, very quiet and very, but very serious. And I know he had two horses. He took one across the river at times in winter.
I can't remember that, but he was, you know, he was like, I suppose, any doctor of that period in a rural community. They all were pretty much the same. He was quiet, yes. How much knowledge he had of medicine, I don't know. But you didn't have, none of them had much then anyway. Most of them don't have much in today. So at that period, they obviously didn't have much. And, you know, he'd give you pills for what ailment you had. And, but he was, that's what we probably always went to.
So he must have delivered you.
I can't answer that. I don't know.
I think he did deliver me.
I don't. Well, I would have been born in the house. I know you were. I don't think you were in the hospital. No, my mother didn't go to the hospital. So I'm assuming I was born in the house across there.
Okay. What about the Indians? Dominic, Nellie, Francis, Frankie.
I remember them. Yes. Yeah.
What do you remember? Anything?
Well, not particularly. I mean, they lived down here. It was a piece of property my father owned afterwards. It's just on the tracks, and they used to sell furniture. I don't remember much about them. I forgot about Dominic. I remember he lived in a little shack by the tracks.
Sure.
Yeah.
Was he the hump?
Yes, I guess he was. Yes, I can just remember. Yeah.
And Laughing Louie was the other one.
I've never heard of him. Well, I mean, that doesn't ring a bell with me. But Nellie Francis, it does. Yes, I remember.
Okay.
But I suppose, were they here the whole time? I forget. I'm my guess is they were nomadic, and they may have lived in the shack here for a while, and they moved around Kings County. They may have been in Sussex. They may have been. I think they moved.
Here.
They were nomadic as their,
I think,
as is their nature.
Previous to you, but I may be wrong. Activities at the Grove when General H.H. McLean was lieutenant governor.
No, I remember that. No, I was, yes. That's right.
You did go to it?
Well, some Christmas parties there, yeah.
What went on?
Well, it was just like any other party. You know, like she, not Mrs. McLean, but his daughter, Mrs. Stetson, acted as his hostess after McLean was a widow. And she was very conscious of what she felt was that right type of activity, you know, in the lieutenant governor. And the lieutenant governor was thought to be somebody of importance at that time, whatever he was. You know. There again, McLean, of course, went bust before his term was over. He had no money at all. I remember him coming to the door of our house in 19, whatever, as soon as he, my father had no money till my grandfather died, and then he had some money. But McLean begging my father to buy the grove. I'm very pleased he didn't, but he wanted to get rid of it. He had no money. He was bust. He had nothing. And I remember people telling me, they kept him on as lieutenant governor because he had nothing. Colonel Barker telling me, McLean sitting down in his underwear one night saying, well, I have nothing. I've lost everything. And he had. He was right. Well,
it
was very sad. So they kept him on. He kept the job a bit longer as lieutenant governor because he had no money. So once he no longer had that job, he was too old to really go. It was long practice. It was gone. But, the son wasn't much of a liar. But I guess they had great parties there. But again, we found the great parties in terms of New Brunswick. How great were they? I don't know.
Well, what would you wear?
Oh, well, these were just children parties I went to, but then there were other parties I can remember. If they say if the Governor General were somebody like that, and you had did have people that, I don't know, during the time I was here, what members of the British royalty, or there must have been some visits, or were they, I don't know. And then obviously if he was left in the government, then there were certain people visited, and they would be, well, the place would be lit with lights outside and whatnot, or lanterns and this sort of thing. It seemed very grand to us, but how grand it was in retrospect, I'm not certain. There again, it was probably as grand as most things going on. But see, this was, you know, this, you know, when I look back on it, I have a bit of a love-hate this relationship with my British colleagues in my old age. We still regard me as a colonial boy, and I find it fascinating because I have been around most parts of the so-called empire that Britain was able to con us into fighting two of her wars and this sort of thing. But this was, so my memories now, and I don't want to be unfair in this, but I'm not atypical of this area. I'll be specific. I fly the Acadian flag here from time to time. I always fly it in a week. The first time I flew it, somebody stole it to try and make a point with me when I first came back. So my Tory stripe is considerably redder here than most of the people in this village. I don't approve of their racism and their British, you know, and their anti-French, their anti-this, their anti-that. I've lived away from here more than I've ever lived here. Very pro-French. I'm very pro-black. I worked with blacks most of these. You know, when I grew up here, there was a black man that was hair. I mean, most of our troubles, and I think society stemmed from those nonsense. You know, Ireland now, which has got the point that it's done it for so long, they don't want to do anything else but butcher each other, and Lebanon and all these sort of things. And that comes from now. This was because of British attitudes. While they looked down on us, we then adopted those same patterns in a place like Rossay. The place English speaking New Brunswick was very pleased with itself. When they didn't know the French existed here. I find it, I used to say to my parents, kid, and one of I talked about having a maid or something in the house. Well, the first person we had was Emily Legere. But I didn't know she wasn't like me. I didn't know she was an Acadian. I didn't know that till I was grown up and she'd long since gone. Nobody told me there were two ethnic religious problems as a small boy. She had to speak English because we never spoke French. We didn't even think about the French. They didn't count. So half the problems you're having with problems today in French English is because of the arrogance, the ignorance, the lack of understanding of people from, if you said you're from Sussex, from King's County, which was 95% Protestant, English and proud of it, and didn't give a damn about the French, didn't want to know about them, regarded them as lower than, you know, we all like to kick somebody, so English being King's County, you kick the Acadians. Well, now all you see, those who kick get kicked, and now, of course, all the hoo-ha and all these other things, because people weren't taught at that time. And so my parents were bringing up in Rossay, were all very much in the so-called British tradition. And Mrs. Schumacher, whose father, Sir Douglas Hazen, was Chief Justice, and he'd been in Borden's Imperial War Cabinet. Her origin, that orientation was England. Everything England was right. So you became very self-satisfied, that whole British, the Brits had that pattern, and that's the way the society was. So if the lieutenant governor is important, you see, and he is a visiting thing here, and that's all, is important to the people in Rossay. I don't know how important it was to the people living in Prince Edward Street in St. John. I didn't even ask them what they thought of it. But to Rossay, it was important, I think.
So
what went on at the McLean's?
Is that why my next question, festivities for the Prince of Wales in 1919, I believe, is the correct.
Well, I can't remember that, but I can remember all the talk about it. Yes, so obviously it was very important to. But of course, we now know the Prince of Wales is a piece of nonsense. But we didn't think that in the 20s or 30s. In fact, we didn't even, when I was small, obviously we still didn't think it when he became Edward the Eighth. You know, but now, as we know more about him, we know he was a fool of the first water.
Well,
really pretty pathetic group at that. But no, he made a great impression on the Great Empire Tour.
That's interesting. I've never given, nobody's given me quite that aspect or view of, on, or perception of Rosse, how we were, I didn't realize, I guess, how dedicated we were to Britain, although it's, you've read it in your history.
Yes, and and St. John, Halifax are going to be more that way than, say, Toronto. Not that Toronto the Good wasn't that way, but all our trade was with Britain. Well, with Confederation, then, of course, we have to look towards Central Canada, but prior to that, we didn't. So, as I said, the Mackays were trading with other Mackays who went back to Liverpool and established AFD Mackay there. So this is your orientation. And when the Irish who come here, of course, they allow them to move to the United States and so on, so we look that way, but we didn't look to Central Canada.
So there would be a lot of French in this area previous to us, obviously.
The French? No, not many. There were never much French here, no. You see, they used your French, but then after the the expulsion, they came back, they didn't settle here. So growing up here, and even in Moncton, you see, I don't hold me to the figures, but I think I'm correct in saying in 1900, this province is, what, only 6 or 7% French. At the start of the First War, I don't think they were 10% French. And Moncton, Moncton doesn't exist until really the railroad. And then when the French go back, they settle right at the north. And then they began to move down like a scimitar. And then Moncton becomes the center. So really, when my parents were small, they were virtually, you never came in contact with the French. So then, they were oriented toward Britain, so they never saw an Acadian at all. They saw them until they were growing up. Mm-hmm. And then they thought in terms of being a servant, really.
Because not understanding
that.
I see. Okay. That's very interesting to have in case.
They've heard all of it, but it was the first fire. Mr. Sayre was, we lived next door to the Sayres, and Mr. Sayre, I think it wasn't elected council, but Mr. Sayre and Mr. Crosby were the first town council, and maybe one other person. And the first fire engine was quartered in the Sayres garage, and the first fire, I think, was at the Sayres house in the basement, and I can remember as a small boy looking out because the Sayres basement was on fire. And I remember Jeff Sayre, who was our fire chief afterwards, still alive on the village council, he'd been brought over to our house and all his brothers and sisters. I don't know how old Jeff would be then. Let's say he's a couple, 2 or 3 years older than I am. I was probably less under six. I don't know that much, but he's small. I remember my mother, bundling him up in a towel or a blanket. And that's when we were all watching the fire in the basement of the Sayre's house. I don't hold me to the facts of it, but from memory, the story always was that they had only had the fire in a few days when the Sayre's basement caught fire. Now, whether they used that pump or it was a little chemical tank in the back of whether they used that for fire, I guess they did, I can't remember. But I remember that first fire engine.
Do you remember any more fires that happened?
Well, I remember, yes, later on, of course, the Allison fire, which is Mr. Walter Allison's fire down there. As I say, I can vaguely remember the Donbo fire. I must be quiet. I wasn't out of it. I remember all the talk about the companion house to this one, which I think was 25 or 26, the Donbo house. The Allison house is later. It's 1930 or whatever.
Okay,
Allison
I'm confused
fire.
About the Walter Allison house. Who lived there previously or after? Because did not...
Well, no, Walter Allison built a fine house there. It was the Manchester Robertson Allison. And it was a fine house. And then it burns, and I can't remember the exact date. Their cook afterwards was with Rebecca Lonsby, with my mother for many years. Became part of our family. He was with us here. And just died 2 years ago. She could have told you all about it, because she was a small girl. She was a young girl. She was a housemaid in Allison's house around 19 or 20, up years of age. She was with them in that fire. Then it burnt. And then again, we're into the Depression. So Walter Allison couldn't afford to rebuild it. And Manchester Robertson House was doing very poorly in the Depression. So he bought a house, which is now Dr. Morse's. I'm sure he lived in there for a short time, which is just on the right, just after you get past Lowood. And then he rebuilt again that current house. He built on the foundations of the old house. I don't know when he built that, but there was a period of, let's call it, 10 to 15 years in which there was no house there.
Well,
there
who
was just
owned
the
Kinghurst?
Oh, Kinghurst is the next lot.
That's
that. Not that. That's where Campbell Mackay House was built, and that was the Will Allison house.
Oh.
I don't know whether they were brothers or brothers. That's the Will Allison house. Different.
Oh, I was under.
No, Walter Allison is where the. Back of Charles Mackay's house. Do you know that, where Charles Mackay lives in that Berry Box looking house? That house up behind it was a second Walter Allison house, which he built on the foundation of his first house. The house which looked a bit, the Will Allison house, which was a school at one time, before Netherwood, a girls' school, and looked a bit like the old part of Netherwood. I can remember that. The Allisons lived there. That was torn down by Mr. Campbell Mackay in 1936, or 37, to build the brick house which she built.
Okay, tell me more about that. Tell me what... Okay, it was a girls' school for a while.
I can't remember. That's before my time. I don't remember what the school, I don't know how big it was, but I know for a while it was run as a girls' school.
Yes.
And I don't know when Mr. Will Allison bought it.
Did the same place turn into a dairy, or is it the other, another place?
No, that's the one. Campbell Mackay built that house, mm-hmm. and then he ran his Kinghurst Dairies there. He built that up. He had the finest Jersey herd in New Brunswick. But he did all that when he left the family timber business in 36. So he could only afford to do that once my grandfather died. They didn't have any money till grandfather died. And then they had some cash to do, so he built that house.
I see. Okay, because I knew somehow he had been involved.
Oh, he was very much involved in that town, but ran that whole dairy for years, yeah, and made a lot of money. I mean, he did very well on it. He built all those workmen's houses. But Campbell and Guy was a very shrewd investor. He made money in the stock market because he knew about the investment business very well. And his son, of course, is one of the leaders in Pittsburgh Mackay afterwards, Mr. Douglas Mackay.
Okay. So your grandfather...
Dehinda,
your father was interested at that time, but you weren't.
Well, because I never saw the Dehinda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grandfather disposed of the Dehinda long before I came along. I don't know when he sold it, but he wasn't around. We had photographs of it.
Oh, you did?
Well, it was about a 60-foot schooner, bigger than anything you really know.
I see. Okay. Winter sports we went over, skating we went over, tragedies on the river
Well, I don't think there's any tragedy. I guess the odd person drowned, but that's another thing.
Every big water place has people drowning. Train travel, train wrecks. Riverboat. I don't know if we went very much on it.
We didn't talk about the riverboats. I have you. There were riverboats going up here, but we weren't so conscious of it. I was conscious of the St. John riverboats because my mother's family, the old family home was in Sheffield below Fredericton, and we used to go up there as very small children for 2 or 3 weeks in the old family farmhouse. And I'm very conscious of, and we went up by riverboat sometimes because the riverboats went from St. John to Fredericton every day. Oh, yeah, and one went up and one went down every day, and then latterly, one went up and then went back. But, I mean, in the old days, you had one leaving Fredericton every morning and one leaving St. John every morning, stopping at all the wharves. That's the way the produce came to St. John. It was brought by that sloven type of thing, the barrels of cabbages are rolled onto the, they're taken down by the horse and wagon, all those stops in the river, and the wharves are still there, or the remains of them, and then the produce, all those farmers in that Sheffield area, they sent their stuff down to Indian Town, and it was sold them out here. But so I remember going. I remember those river boats, and they did, of course, the same thing. But I'm not as conscious of the river boats coming up the Kennebecasis because they didn't go very far. Whereas the ones spreading go out to St. John, they went right up. The one time she never went to Woodstock, but they did go to Hampton.
Yes.
And the ones I remember are the D.J. Purdy, which was the second or third D.J. Purdy, and the Majestic, and the Hampton, the paddle wheeler. But I remember the Hampton on the St. John River, not really on this river. I think it'd be both. But I can remember seeing the old stern wheeler. But as a small boy, again, we were on the Kingston Peninsula when I was 6 or 7. That's where I learned to row a boat, swimming.
Okay. Swimming off the rest of the
water. Well, we didn't talk about that, but you've heard that. I think you've heard.
Yeah,
you've heard that. We used to swim off that.
Okay.
The water was clean.
That's the houses. Early days of motoring, first the flat tires, and when you're driving, first pavement, the valley was across.
Yeah, well, my father had about a license, I think he had license number 40 or something. I've talked to Mr. Irving about this. His father's car, I thought ours was 47. I'd have to check it again. I think, perhaps my grandfather's license was 52. That means, and I can remember, it was NB, it's a leather license plate. It used to be around here at Glossop, with the tin numbers, 52 on it, they'll say.
Mm-hmm.
And the Irving car was in the late 40s. So actually, Mr. Irving's father had a car in Bucktouche before grandfather, but about the same time.
So this would number them as...
They just numbers they came out, you see. And my father was the one in the family who drove the car. And that same little book, which came out 2 or 3 years ago, my father was one of the first drivers in this country.
That's interesting.
And he and Mr. John Sayre devised the scheme of... the Sayres had a car very early on. And, of course, the cars with the roads, you would lose a lot of the nuts and bolts. So what Mr. Sayre got, and Dad did, they strung a piece of canvas, you see. Took a piece of canvas and tied it at the four corners where the wheels are. So when the bolt fell out, you didn't lose it in the mud. It just fell into the canvas, and then you could pick it up and put it back where it came from. But Dad was the one in the family who did the driving. And they, grandfathers, had one of the first automobiles here, the Red Russell. I'd have to be careful. It was either a Ford or the Red Russell. And it's not, well, it's in that book. It's either 1902 or 1903. I think it's 1902.
Okay.
And then he from 1911, when General Motors from, he always had Cadillacs. Two big Cadillacs here. They made the fire engine out of the Great Big Open Cadillac.
Did they?
That was a beautiful car. One of the longest cars ever built. 9-passenger open Cadillac. Beautiful, beautiful car. Better than any Jaguar ever seen today. Being built today would cost $200,000. A magnificent thing. Made one in Florida. A fruit peddler bought it to peddle his battalion, peddle his fruit out. And they took that one to this year and made the camp around.
Were you involved very much with fishing, shooting, or camping?
No, I haven't any memories. We may have done a bit of fishing on the river. I'm not conscious of really doing a lot of fishing in the river. I never did any shooting. My father would never shoot me after the war. He never wanted to shoot. And he was gassed. So we never had a gun in the house. So he never did any shooting. He didn't do duck shooting, didn't shoot. Moose shooting.
Okay.
What
about trips to the Long Island? Were you involved with any of those, or just being around the Long Island?
No, I'm not conscious of, because again, when I'm going up the sailing to the Long Island, I did that after the war, but not as a small boy, because there were so few boats, we didn't get over there. Now, some people did, that there were a few cottages there, and they went over, but by and large, I wasn't conscious. Skating in the river, yes, and skating over, but not conscious of being on Long Island in summer.
I see.
Because I'm not conscious, really, of being around the water very much. Well, I've got to take that back. We're sailing with some of the smaller 20-foot boats. My first trip up the river with two of my friends, or three of my friends, we did sail up there, and when we were about 14 or 15, so that'd be in the mid-30s. And we would have gone over. So I suppose, yes, all right, when we started to sail, how old was I? I suppose 40. So you are going over the island then, and sailing around the island, that's right. But not as a small boy, because we didn't have a boat then. So it's not until... Yeah, and then you get in the 30s. And the Sarahs had their boat, the Falcon sailing too. So you get in the mid-30s, then. It was more or less the latter part of the 30s. There wasn't much boating right after the Depression, those first few years. And perhaps from 35, 36 on, and then 3 years after the war.
Okay. I've exhausted all my ideas. Do you feel there's anything that I am missing that you feel?
Well, there's probably lots, yeah. You probably just scratched the surface.
I'm sure.
And I don't know, and perhaps you haven't tried to figure this out yourself, and perhaps it's asking too much to have thought about it. Really, you would have had more background to do it, but you could attack this problem, I suppose, in a number of ways. You could take a look at the Rossi as a microcosm of something or other, and say, what did they really realize? Is the collapse of St. John part of their are they part of the problem? Did they get themselves out here in suburbia and forget about St. John, which is becoming more and more blue collar, or becoming unemployed blue collar? Why weren't they more aggressive in doing this, that, there? Were they really social conscious? Or did they hire them off to suburbia too early and vacate St. John so that it then collapses? If they'd all stayed in the city, would St. John not have collapsed the way it did? You could have approached this a number of other ways. You could perhaps go out to damn them, to expose them for the mess they made of things, or to praise them because they did give leader. I don't know. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yes.
If you've thought about this before, then you could decide, I'm out. And I think this is, I've never done it right. I think this is people really do when they write books, don't they? They get excited about the Vietnamese War, and they either think President X did a good job or a bad job. So they then begin to ask all their questions on the basis. Didn't President Johnson really make a mess of that? But if they're an apologist for President Johnson, they're asking a different set of questions. So if you think of if you say, I either approve or don't approve of this strip here called Rossi, you see, if you formulate an idea of it, then you begin to, as you attack the questioners, you ask for answers, you're forming all your questions. Then as you dig into it, you may find you're not getting the questions you want, and so then you may change your view of it as you ask your questions. You may start out, you may be, say, a strong leftist persuasion, your view may be socialism, you may want to become the leader of the NDP party, so you're out to expose Rossi as an archaic rightist Tory enclave or liberal fat cat enclave, you see.
It was more conservative.
Not really, no, the Fosters lived. I don't think it was small c conservative. But that's all part of the province again, you see, and I could go on in some length in this, but I was appointed as president of the University of Brunswick by a conservative premier, and then suddenly I had to work with a liberal premier, Mr. Louis Robichaud. And somebody came to my father and said, a distinguished businessman, Frederick, and said, he thought my father should speak to me. about my relationships with the premier, making the point it wasn't the truth, it wasn't so much the truth that people were telling the premier about me that I should be concerned about, but the lies they were telling him to try and put a block between us. Now, Louis Robichaud had a very low opinion, of course, of the St. John area. He'd grown up in the north. So his view of this area, this is where the wealth was, this is where the power was, this is where the righteous Tory Anglicans were, who weren't concerned about the poor French-speaking Roman Catholics. And so Robichaud had probably a very distorted view of this, but he has it because of the history of New Brunswick we have now. So just how do you look at a society? I mean, Robichaud's view of this, he would know very little about this, because he never saw Ross Say until he was in his 30s probably. But his view of southern New Brunswick, of St. John, of the Ross Say, would be quite different than, say, somebody who lived here all their life. Let me put it another way. When I was in Ottawa, I just bought a book out of a paperback. But it's a Muslim view of the Crusades. And the Muslims have a quite different view of the Crusades than a Christian does. I haven't read it yet, which is good. I think it's interesting to read about the Crusades from the Muslim's point of view, who we have been brought up to think is the infidel. Well, he never thought himself the infidel. He thinks of the Christians the infidel. So you get a different perspective. Now,
it is perspective.
So you're really just trying to gather up facts. And the trouble, as I say, with the facts you'll get, including my own, they're more fiction than facts, because your memory pays you false. I know this because people ask me about things at the University of New Brunswick when I work at Beaverbrook. And I have to be careful enough. I say something categorically, or something I've done. And it's all in the files. Not that I check a file. I suddenly realize my memory is not of what it was. When the Hungarian students came out, and I had to look up something the other day, and I was quite sure that what had happened and the steps were taken, but I was wrong. Things I had said, we did this, we did that, we did extra this, and the person who did so much work for me, the professor who was Jewish and had been a refugee in China, so I put him on this. I'd forgotten all about the role he played. And he was the one I dumped it on. He did an awful lot of work, but he was a quiet little fellow. And I'd been telling him about this and that, but I suddenly forgot all the work that Professor Viner did. And I went through that file and read all the reports he gave and how concerned he was about those Hungarian students. But we tend to forget these sort of things, so the people you're talking to, have forgotten a lot of things, as I have.
But majority rules. If you have people, five or six people, and there's one or two different.
Well, this is why in this so-called oral history, and this is why I say what you're doing is really not oral history, because oral history, you're really asking people, I would say oral history, you're only asking people, let me be specific again, if somebody asked me about something about Beaverbrook, and I was there, and I say, yes, at that time, and Beaverbrook and I discussed this and that, but and I say, that's oral history, because you're asking me about a fact. But if you're just asking me about Beaverbrook's father, I would say no. I never met Beaverbrook's father. I never met the Reverend Mr. Aiken. So it's all hearsay. So that's really not oral history. So a lot of the stuff I've been talking to you isn't really oral history. It's just old wives' tales. The only thing can be oral history, the things I told you to the best of my knowledge, which I was there. You asked me, what I did at the school. Now that is the oral history, because I'm talking of my knowledge. But the rest of it is just what I've learned around here. People have told me, were they talking fact or fiction again, you see. So it gets pretty blurred. But what you do, and you're right, as you talk to me, as you talk to other people, then you get these different, I say one thing, he says another, she says it differently, all about the same event. Let's take the Ross Say fire engine. Some of them may think that it was put in the Fairweather's barn and not in the Sayers garage. But if you talk to enough about it, you talk to Jeff about it, you realize that most people say it was where it was, in the Sayers garage during that first 2 or 3 weeks. But I'm sure there's some of 2 or 3 people who think it was someplace else. And they will tell you, it was in the little place where they put it up here by the public school, but it wasn't there first at all. That wasn't built.
Yes, I suppose all history is
just... Just one more thing I picked up today, a little pamphlet on the UNB law school.